This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, has President Obama already given up on a second term? It sure sounds like it. Also, a new documentary reveals the inner life of Mitt Romney. Did the American voter misunderstand him? I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, Lena Dunham's Vogue cover was photoshopped. Umbrage ensued. Is it well-founded or just misplaced? Then we'll discuss literature's greatest punctuation marks. That's right. Remember George Eliot's M dashes? And then how should accusations against Woody Allen affect how we feel about his movies?
I would never want to belong to any club that would have someone like me for a member. That's the key joke of my adult life in terms of my relationships with women.
We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. In a wide-ranging New Yorker profile this week, President Obama appeared gloomy and hopeless about his second-term prospects. Has he given up too easily? Then, a new documentary about Mitt Romney, called Mitt, almost humanizes the 47% presidential candidate. Joining me in Washington is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And also Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hello, Emily.
Hey, David.
President Obama has generally been stingy with interviews during his presidency, but this week brings an epic story in The New Yorker from David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, based on hours spent with the president toward the end of his annus horribilis of 2013. Remnick finds a contemplative but rather hopeless president. The usual professorial mode, very thoughtful, very analytical, very sympathetic, very human, but also kind of done. So, John, reading this interview, did you get the sense that Obama was recumbent?
Right, or a man in repose. Well, the first thing that struck me was that it comes at a slightly discordant time because as it comes out, the president and his staff are beating the drums for a several weeks long effort to talk about how 2014 is going to be a year of action. And juxtaposed against that, this was a person who just seemed incapable of like vigorous action. I mean, for a variety of reasons. And the reason he felt that way is in this piece, there's a number of instances in which the president says, as a president, you're here basically, you start like a relay swimmer in a rushing river. And, you know, you just basically, this image of him basically just trying to make some kind of progress in this relay in these terrible conditions. And he talks about how you're really just writing a paragraph in history and you just want to get your paragraph right. There's a scene where he's at a fundraiser and there's a huge applause when somebody shouts out about executive orders. And he throws cold water on the crowd and says, you know, there's a thing called the Constitution and we can't just run and do whatever we want by executive order. This, I'm not arguing that he was finding limitations that aren't there. I think he was coming to the place that previous presidents have come to and that he faces particularly because of the political opposition that he faces. So he was just sort of a little bit exhausted, a little bit frustrated. So that was my initial reaction to
it. It was like a very heavy dose of realism, right? And so I came away with this feeling, my usual respect for Obama's intellectual acumen and his relative level of candor, at least he doesn't seem deluded about his powers. He doesn't seem like an egomaniac. What was missing was the feeling, okay, I've got X amount of time. I am going to do this. And I don't know if that's because David Remnick just wasn't interested in that and so didn't include whatever is on the list. But I really hope the Year of Action has one big thing and maybe two medium to small things and that's it. And we just hear a lot about that and maybe something actually gets done.
Well, there was very little, even on the thing where you would expect there to be a Year of Action, the healthcare.gov or the healthcare.
Well, he was treated as like, oh, we've fixed that problem. Now what's next, right?
I mean, right, which they haven't.
Yeah.
And there was Iran, and he talks about Iran as being something that they're working on for
right.
these 6 months.
But you're right.
No, yeah. There's a whole lack of a sense of that the action is going to actually happen. And that fatalism. There is this moment in every presidency when the president starts having dinner with historians, and you're like, oh, that's it. That's it. We're done.
That's
we're
right, done. Before, right before they start talking to the paintings. It's the dinners with the historians.
You know,
but he started it early.
Mr. Long View.
Because I think, well, and Bush did this too. I mean, when you're a president, historians and history is like the closest thing you've got to a user's manual because you're in this job that nobody, like, it's impossible and there aren't a whole lot of people who've done it, and there aren't many who've done it well, and the situations in which they did it well are peculiar and particular. And so the historians are the best possible thing you can get, especially when everything seems to thwart you, the limitations of the office, the politics you face, your weird staff. Like, it feels like the historians are the ones who might be able to give you
But do you think Doris Kearns Goodwin at this point is like, oh, my, I really have to go to the dinner at the White House again?
No, I don't think
that. Oh, my God. Do I have to talk about Lincoln? They have to compare him to Lincoln again, really?
But I did think it was funny that Robert Caro, who, of course, is the LBJ biographer, felt like Obama was giving him the cold shoulder simply for writing a book that presents LBJ as this very muscular, you know, crackheads president.
Well, I think that says more about Robert Caro's self-involvement than it does about Obama,
truthfully. That could totally be the case.
I thought that passage could use a little of David's.
A little critical distance.
Yes. But one thing that's funny about that is, remember when President Clinton reviewed Caro's book for the Times, I guess it was the Times, in which he basically wrote his review as a letter to Barack Obama to take the lessons of Johnson. So Caro may not have been trying to send that message. By the way, Caro, like, he hardly could have targeted it for Obama since he started writing it 20
years
ago.
Right, and there is, I mean, I do think we've talked about this sometimes before, but there is this big debate and fight over President Obama. Is he someone who does not have even the slightest ounce of LBJ in him? And yes, the politics are different and, you know, there isn't the same room for corruption and earmarks that there used to be for getting things done, that deal making we'd find out about too quickly. But even with all of that, is he just kind of lame on this front in a way that matters incrementally?
Right. Well, we know it's a flaw. The question is whether it's a meaningless flaw. So let's say he was awesome at it's not just at schmoozing. Let's say he loved politics.
Yes.
He just doesn't love the job he's chosen. And that's probably highly natural and normal because politics
is
weird.
It's why he's likable, right?
Right. Probably why. That's right. And so let's say, though, that he loved politics and he was great at schmoozing. It still might have gotten him nowhere significant.
What if he was also great at threats, though? I mean, there's that anecdote from the New York Times that when he really needed, who was it?
Mark Begich.
Mark Begich's vote for gun control, and then Mark Begich dissed him, and there were no consequences. Now, is that something that is inevitable, or is that a failure of the president's?
Right.
You know, I don't know. Well,
one question I have for you, John, about just on this point. So we do come back to, well, he doesn't try to make nice with the Boehners and the Eric Cantor. He's not having them over to hang out with them. And you could say, well, he's not having them over, but it doesn't matter because they wouldn't have voted for him. But it's kind of a counterfactual. We just don't know. It is striking in the Remnick piece that he really doesn't care about it, that he doesn't play golf with them. He doesn't have them over. He doesn't call them on their birthdays or, you know, send their kids presents for their bat mitzvahs.
Again, this is an enduring question. He doesn't want to do it. But would it really matter? And let's take it one step further. Would it actually be counterintuitive? If John Boehner, and there was a passage, I guess it's in this piece, although it's been reported elsewhere before, that he's several different times invited senior members, McConnell, Boehner, to come over, and they've turned down his invitation. Why? Because if you do a deal with the president, that hurts you in your own politics. And so a lot of times, and immigration's a great example, if immigration comes to pass, it will be in no small part because the president read the landscape and understood it and understood that he needed to stay out of the debate because once he touched something that had to do with immigration, it immediately made it less popular among Republicans. And so I think there's a very strong case to be made in some instances, schmoozing and the kind of touching of Republicans that some people call for would be absolutely detrimental to getting something done. Having said that, and I totally think that's true, whether he has them over or calls them on their birthday or does those kinds of things, which, for those listening, sometimes do matter in the
Did
way
politics—
Did you
just forget to call someone on their birthday, John?
No, I meant matter in the petty world of Washington. I don't think that's the sum and substance of his deficiencies when it comes to the nitty-gritty of politics, which isn't to say he has only failures. I think he hinted at this in this piece that, at least on gay marriage— He basically lied is too strong a word, but he dissembled repeatedly and constantly about his position to both send a signal to his supporters that someday he would change, but also not to go far enough to turn people off in 2008.
And on legalizing pot, he's done the same thing. It's clear what he really thinks. It's not worth the political capital to him to say, yeah, let's go legalize, as it wasn't for a long time with gay marriage. And he's, you know, waiting until it's safer. And that is either a very sensible, pragmatic choice or a moral failing.
John, you posed a cute mental exercise for us before.
Cute.
It was profound, David.
Profound mental exercise. Which was to say, what is it that you wish had been asked? If you were locked in the room with President Obama for 4 hours, what are the things that you would press him on? We'll just like round robin it.
Okay. Well, my first question was, okay, you have this defense of the way you do politics, but surely there is an area or one big thing you wished you'd pushed harder on and that you think you could have gotten done if you'd knocked some heads together or schmoozed more properly. What is that? What's the thing that you hold yourself accountable for failing to do? And I know this is going on too long, but was gun control a big waste of your time? Because that wasn't going to be the thing that you were going to win. And should you have deployed yourself in a direction like immigration or energy or climate change where you might have actually deployed the powers of the office more effectively?
All right, let's be faster. That was a long question. All right, Molly, go next.
Maybe I don't get to
win
the next round.
I would like to know, what exactly were you doing in the weeks and months before the healthcare launch? Like, really, what was your involvement with all of that?
Well,
why do you think it got so
botched?
That's the thing to me. Here is this thing, your signature item, the thing that you will do probably at the end of your 8 years that will do more to balance income inequality than anything else you're ever going to get past. You put so much capital and blood and sweat and tears in. What happened? And what does it say to you about the capacity for anything to happen? Just talk. Just say something, you know? And if he said nothing, that would be just as interesting as if he had some theory of the case. So I feel the same with you, David. But also,
We each get a second one.
Okay.
Your second one first.
Oh, his campaign was so risky in 2008. He took gambles. Now, believe me, nobody believes more in the difference between campaigning and governing. But when did he, other than bin Laden, take a risk? I want to get at how it's possible, if it's even possible, to be creative as a president. Or are you just so bound in by things that the options are always sort of A, B, or C, and they're all well-worn, and there's just no room for creativity? Because if you try to be creative and you fail, then it's a huge political nightmare that you have to deal with for 3 weeks. But something at that line between risk and creativity.
All right, Emily, quickly.
This is stolen from you. What's your big mistake or regret? What do you think you screwed up that you can tell us about?
And mine is the Obama campaign from the beginning was premised on the idea that there's one America. Is there one America? Does he still believe there's one America? If not, why is there not one America?
Did you ever believe there was? I guess he did.
Well,
he talked a little bit about that.
Yeah, he did.
So this is also, in terms of the Obama question, he seems to be almost embarrassed about his message of 2008, that he was going to create a kind of postpartisan new way in Washington. It's not possible. And so either, or it hasn't been possible. And that's either his failure or a failure of the people he faced in Washington. If the people in Washington that he faced were so dead set against him, how then did he not see it coming?
And shouldn't he have given up on it long before he did and saved us all a lot of heartache?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's save our listeners a lot of heartache. Coming up, the astonishing new behind-the-scenes documentary about Mitt Romney's failed presidential campaign. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. This week marks the release of Mitt, a Netflix documentary about former presidential candidate Mitt Romney. The Romney family granted director George Whiteley enormous access to family discussions and to the presidential campaigns of 2008 and 2012, with the proviso that Whiteley couldn't release anything until after the Romney presidency or after the campaigns were done. So this 90-minute movie shows Romney on the road. It shows the Romneys praying, talking about his debates. It shows Romney thinking about whether to run, how the campaign is going.
Ironing his own tuxedo.
His own tuxedo. I think the premise of this movie, at least if you're a Romney, someone who is sympathetic to Romney or wanted to be sympathetic to Romney, was that, gosh, it's too bad this didn't get out earlier because Romney needed to show the inner Mitch, needed to show this private family man to the world. It would have made him more likable and accessible. If we could only have seen him with his family, it would have made all the difference. Now, having seen this movie, I am very, very, very skeptical that this would have helped at all.
Why? But, tell.
Well, let's discuss it. I mean, what was striking to me about this movie is how incredibly dull it was. You do have a picture of a family that is clearly loving. It's beautiful family. Beautiful. You
know, many jutting jaws.
The children, the Romney children are gorgeous.
And the jaws of the sons all
the
jut.
Sons,
and
the
eyes
the
all
dental
sparkle.
Work.
Is
beautiful.
The flannel
and
shirts.
They love each other, and they are clearly, you know, he's a man who works hard. He means well. The absence in this movie was any sense that he was running for the greater good of the country. It was all very about Mitt Romney and how Mitt Romney felt about himself. And I
don't think that's totally fair. And to the extent that it is, I think it's partly that the movie was entirely devoid of policy.
Choice. Right? Yes, it was a choice by the filmmaker.
Yeah, I mean, they gave Romney one or two kind of stump speech moments about the guy with the small business who's giving 2/3 of his revenue to the government and how stifling that is. But for the most part, it is stripped of any actual political, here's what I would do in office content. And so instead, what you're left with is, yes, I get your sense that there's a dullness. I would also argue, though, that they were completely more likable, and that if it was just a matter of getting beyond the stiff Mitt Romney facade, which I never got beyond that as a, you know, observer and voter, I think the movie does succeed. I also, though, just thought it was like too long and had these little fascinating moments about the grind of the political process, but also just a lot of just kind of padding.
I mean, this is basically a Romney home movie as opposed to a political movie. You know, in a political movie, you're used to seeing two things. One, constant swearing. There is not a single swear word. There is a reference to a swear word when one of the Romney kids hears that John Kerry is making fun of Romney for his elevator. And he said, why don't you tell him it's for your wife who has MS, you a-hole. That's the closest you get to a swear word in the entire movie.
But I don't think that's fake. These people don't curse. They pray.
No, I understand.
That.
No. But my point is that's why it's a movie about the family.
I see.
Not a movie about politics.
Completely. There is barely an advisor in the entire
that's
movie.
That's the other point I was going to make is that there are no advisors. You see even Stuart Stevens, who has a tiny little role at the end, you don't see him. You just hear him mumbling and it's shot through a water glass. That's in part because it's when the actual campaign is election night. But the point is this is all about the family.
Yeah, Paul Ryan's on camera for like 5 seconds.
Right.
Ooh, and how awkward was
and
that
boy,
interaction?
Was that
yeah,
awkward.
That was bad.
Wow. That was bad.
So I think what this ended up being was not a reason why he should have been, but a sort of this is an intimate portrait of what it's like to go through a campaign. And I think anybody who ever wants to run for president should probably watch this.
God, really? Why did you think it was an intimate portrait? I thought it was an intimate portrait of what it's like to hang out with your family
right,
in hotel rooms.
That's what I mean.
But that's what it is like. And sleep on the floor of the plane or in the seat of the plane and be, you know, incredibly rich and privileged and yet at the mercy of the focus group of 28 people who are going to determine your fate as a political candidate.
I think that's why I say anybody who's thinking of running, for what it does to them and what it does to the family. Again, not as a political movie, but as a purely as a personal thing, this is what happens to you and your family and what you go through when you run for president. And, you know, if you're up for that and you can handle that, then go for it. But that's a pretty small audience of people.
Can I talk to you guys about one thing which I observed, which may have been totally unfair, but if you could take the archetypal scene of this movie, it's them all sitting around a hotel room and talking, right?
And praying.
And praying a bit. In those scenes, Romney's sons speak a lot, particularly Tag and Josh. The daughters-in-law never speak.
Maybe once.
Maybe once. One is asked, and she speaks a little bit. There's a very powerful scene where Ann Romney talks directly to Mitt when they're alone. But Ann Romney in those public group scenes basically never speaks. It's a dialogue among men. Even though there are all these women around.
Now, well, is part
men,
of it that they're not his daughter?
I don't know if that's a choice, but it was striking.
Well, it is striking.
How absent the women's voices were.
I completely also noticed it. I explained it as the daughters-in-law are not his daughters.
Yeah.
And so it's much harder to be the person standing up to your dad or even ribbing your dad at a tense moment in the campaign if it's not actually your dad. And I felt like they all saw themselves as one step removed from having a role in the campaign. That's wrong, but
I think that also Ann Romney is, to the extent, again, that this is a family movie rather than a political movie. I mean, it's obviously a family movie about politics, but I mean, she is pretty constant presence.
She's a presence, but she's not.
She's quiet, except
in
the group scene, she's very quiet.
Yeah, but if you think of the characters who have the weight in the film, she is.
But she comes across as a helpmeet, right? A companion, not someone who's strategizing, not someone who
Right, but
is,
that's, I mean.
That's a lot.
That's great. And every candidate should have that because you've got what you do see in the those scenes after the debates where everybody's like telling what a great job, especially the second debate. He knows he hasn't done very well. And everybody's telling him what a great job he is. If the wife was included in that litany of happy talk, it would be horrible. And you wouldn't want a wife to be doing that. And B, it would diminish what she does do, which it seems to me in the film, which is have a real weight with him that is different and separate from all the strategists and their happy talk or their advice or all of that.
Totally. No, I don't think that's – I don't think your analysis is wrong at all. I'm just – my point was merely observational, that even though there are women in every single shot in the movie, there are very few women voices in it. And I don't
I felt
know
like
why
it was a very
is.
Traditional family. A family – you know, there is a strong thread of patriarchy in the Mormon faith and the Mormon tradition, and these are conservative people. That's right. What I thought.
Well, it's also – well, I mean, but you, if you look at the Obama White House and team, it's a boys' club. Too. So that's
not
a Mormon.
Contradicting you that's about
not
that.
A, well, but I guess not a Mormon. It's a politics.
If you filmed them inside, would Valerie Jarrett be talking
well,
as much as
Michelle
and
Obama
Michelle be
and Malia and Sasha Obama? He doesn't have sons. It's a different dynamic.
Yeah. Well, and also Beth Myers, you know, was Romney's top. I mean, was his campaign manager and longtime top assistant.
How many campaign managers did he have? He had like 12 campaign managers.
Well, she was. It was another guy. Complicated. Yeah.
I just think what you were seeing, and maybe it's the filmmaker's choice, it seemed like a separate spheres family in which the men were talking politics and were playing the aggro role and the women were sitting back a little bit.
Clearly, it's a traditional family in which it's irrefutable. I guess we don't know, though, how much of it was editing and also how much of it was given the role that Mrs. Romney played in his life, in this marriage, it would have seemed weird for her to be like chucking strategy in those stupid round and round conversations. It just would have seemed beneath her.
I don't.
There's some way that you can speak up and not have it seem like you're saying some dumb beneath you thing, right?
I don't know. Speak up about like how you're supposed to rebut Obama. Like, I don't know.
Golden silence. Yeah,
she's just sitting with her
Women
sons
should
and
be
daughter-in-law.
Seen and not
not,
heard.
She's not, she's not with Stuart Stevens and Matt Rhodes telling them
yeah,
how to run
but
it.
Yeah, but the nature of the conversation
is just a family
is,
conversation, which she is not part of.
That's not true about the – so the film begins with a conversation before the 2008 race where they go around the room and ask the various family members for their opinions about the personal question of whether he should run. And that, unfortunately, is counter to your thesis because it's the daughter-in-law who speaks, and basically she has that scene. But in the strategy meetings, not the personal meetings, but in the, like, what do you say in the debate meetings, it would have felt weird, wouldn't it? For it?
I don't know. All right, last question. Would you guys – how would you rate this compared to The War Room or to The Street Fight or any of the other political documentaries you've seen? Or you would not call it a political documentary?
No,
it's
I would call it a, you know, home movie about a political figure. I think it's a little tamer and duller. It has its appealing moments. I mostly wanted it to be about half the length that it was.
I mean, it's just great to see what it's like in those rooms. I spent some time in those scenes with when John McCain was running. It's weird. You're surrounded by people in half your day, and then the other time you're sitting alone with your family in a crappy hotel room.
Wait, who knew that they watched the results on TV?
Yeah.
I mean, of course they do. What else are they supposed
I know,
to do?
But
and
it
yet
is,
it's so weird,
it's
right?
very weird and isolating, and I thought it captured some of that pretty well. I also think likability is sort of silly theater review about presidential campaigns, but I think he was a more likable, honest, and kind of real human being, particularly when he talks about how people view him as a flip-flopper and his self-awareness about the caricature of Mitt Romney was alive throughout that film and in various moments. I don't think it has any bearing on the race, but it gives you a view into him that we never got to see and never would necessarily see in the course of a campaign. And so that's just interesting, and to the extent that it was hidden and now you get to see something that was once hidden.
Right. That'll do it for the political GabFest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture GabFest starts right now.
This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture GabFest, Lena Dunham's photo spread in Vogue magazine has sparked a furor. We'll discuss that and the politics of imperfect bodies. And then even as Woody Allen is being singled out as a great filmmaker by the award shows, he's being called out as a child molester by his own children. How should we, the bystanders, respond? And finally, the greatest punctuation marks in literature. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And then subbing in for Dana Stevens this week is David Haglund, who's a you're still the editor of Browbeat, correct?
That's right, Steve.
Okay. And Browbeat is the culture blog of Slate magazine. All right. Digging right in. Body positive feminist Lena Dunham makes a point on her HBO show Girls of showing off her own, at least by the standards of Vogue magazine, imperfect body. So it was a little strange, admittedly, to see her posing slim-downed, hourglassed, and hollow-cheeked in none other than Vogue magazine. A glorious and proud imperfection had come up against the standards of so-called perfection, at least as enforced by glossy magazines. And perfection appeared to win out. This, as it should have, raised an internet firestorm. But should it have resulted in a bounty? The website Jezebel offered $10,000, that's 10 large, for a pre-Photoshop images from the photo shoot of Lena Dunham. And I should add, they got them. Julia, this is a lot of story here. What did I leave out, and where do you fall on this issue?
Steve, how dare you call Lena Dunham's body imperfect, you tool of male hegemony?
I added quickly by the standards of Vogue magazine.
No, I hear you. I'm just teasing. This was a totally fascinating, thorny internet fracas that I think confused some of the usual battle lines in debates around photoshopping and standards of beauty on the internet. You know, so Jezebel, which is the feminist website as part of the Gawker Media empire, that was basically founded as a counterpoint, opposition, antagonist to the classic standard glossy women's magazines that, you know, that for years have perpetuated impossible beauty standards and inane tips about pleasing your men and all the usual things that get complained about with regard to women's magazines. And early on, Jezebel scored a big media coup by offering to pay money for any pre-retouching photos of a celebrity, and scored some photos of the lithe, blonde, and beautiful Faith Hill before she had been made even more lithe, blonder, and beautifulier on the cover of, I think, Allure, maybe, herself?
Red Book.
Red Book, yeah. You know, and I think this was universally seen as great. How fun. An internet provocateur calling these dumb magazines to task for their stupidity. They've continued to police this beat over the years, and I think led to a much wider awareness of just how photoshopped the images we see usually are. I think probably they have some design directors and photo editors running a little bit scared in terms of how they treat the bodies of the women that they present. And in general, you know, as a card-carrying member of the Feminists of America, I would say that generally Jezebel is doing God's work on this front. Then they call for unretouched photos of Lena Dunham in Vogue, and it just gets confusing, right? I feel that the thing that's confusing here is that if you are a feminist in America today, in a way you feel a little bit like Lena Dunham's body belongs to you, because it feels like she has given it to us in a way, right? Like if you're a fan of her show, which I am, the way in which she presents her own very real, normal body is super liberating and exciting and cool, and it feels great to see a body like that on screen. And so there is something jarring about her getting kind of shoehorned into this glossy, idiotic Vogue format, you know. But Lena Dunham could have chosen to release those photos herself, and she didn't. So there is something to me that feels a little bit weird in going after her specifically, as opposed to saying, here's a bounty, bring us photos of somebody. Let's find photoshopping of somebody. To say, let's find photoshopping of this specific woman, even if it's because you have a misguided sense that her body is every woman's body now. It's not. It's still her body. On her show, she gets to control how it's presented. She made the decision to go with Vogue, which, who wouldn't? It's like a big way to do publicity for her show. So that's what I came to after kind of wrestling through it a little bit. I'm curious to hear what you guys made of it, having not been, you know, personally scarred by visions of women in magazines through your teen years, or perhaps having been scarred in different ways.
Well, I confess, Julia, my reaction was much more immediate and hasn't really changed, which is that I found the initial Jezebel post distinctly disingenuous, and I found the second one, which included the unretouched photos, unconvincing. I think that it's a huge difference between calling for any unretouched cover photo and calling for, as you said, one specific woman's photos. And like you said, I think Dunham has a very specific place within this discussion when it comes to the way female bodies are depicted. I also thought that the bounty felt like a naked ploy for traffic. Yes, you could see how Vogue slimmed her down in sort of the way you expect them to do, but there was no revelation there that was new about what Vogue does. All it did was to call attention to Dunham's compromise, as you sort of hinted at the end there, compromise with Vogue and their own standards. That was always going to be the story. And I think there are people at Jezebel smart enough to know that.
I also thought, you know, some people said the resulting photos were a big so what, because there didn't actually appear to have been that much retouching. She didn't get lollipopped. Her face didn't become emaciated. In fact, the retouching seemed, to my standards, to be pretty modest. You know, they didn't seem to include all the different photos that were in the spread. But for the ones that you could see, it was like, yeah, I would have been glad that they, like, moved up my neckline so that my armpit flesh didn't look so weird. Steve, what did you make of it all?
Well, Julia, I like your beautifully expressed thought that in some ways there's a kind of feminist public ownership of Lena Dunham's body, and that in a way they were going to retrieve, you know, I mean, the pretense at least to the bounty is, well, we're going to retrieve it for her. Nonetheless, I do think that Lena Dunham, part of the image that she's cultivated both as the author of a remarkable show, Comedy of Manners, and through the character of Hannah, she's by producing her naked body week after week on the show, she's saying, I'm really all but coming out and saying, I don't secretly aspire to look like that, where that is the cover of these magazines. Regardless of what Jezebel's motivations were precisely, I do understand how a collective umbrage could rise up in response to her retracting that and saying, well, in fact, I do aspire to look like that. I kind of would like to look like a Vogue cover model. But when she herself was asked about it in Paris, you know, Lena Dunham gave a response that I thought was disingenuous. And I think she deserves to be called on that. I mean, she says she doesn't really understand why there's a kerfuffle precisely, and she doesn't feel objectified. She felt that Vogue was very supportive. I mean, she gave a really kind of mamby-pamby answer, whereas she's risen to prominence by being anything but mamby-pamby and kind of having it both ways. And then I would just add a personal note. Julia, you say scarred, and then you quickly added, well, possibly you were scarred. I actually do think young men are scarred by these images. They're, you know, that expectation doesn't land just in the psyches of women. They land in the psyches of young heterosexual men who are led to believe that this is somehow out there in the world and desirable. And that is scarring. That's terrible. And so in a way, she collaborated with something that maybe that people have, I don't think mistakenly, have regarded her as standing firmly against.
I think my feeling about Lena Dunham is maybe a little bit of disappointment and a little bit of relief, right? Like, it's true that the author of Girls seems like someone, if you were expecting her to be politically consistent across all texts with which she was ever associated, would be someone who would be like, look at my armpit flesh and be glad, right? Who would be like, don't tweak the neckline on the photo of me sitting in a dingy bathtub with Adam Driver. On the other hand, it's a little bit of a relief, right? It's like, yeah, in some contexts, everybody would prefer to not have a shot of your armpit flesh just like floating around there on the internet. You know, so it's in some ways it makes her seem more relatable. And I can relate to that. I mean, there's a great quote in Tina Fey's Bossy Pants, which someone pointed out on Twitter, where she says, I feel about Photoshop the way some people feel about abortion. It is appalling and a tragic reflection on the moral decay of our society, .. unless I need it, in which case everybody be cool.
Coming up, the greatest punctuation marks in history. You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with David Hagland and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mention on the program, we collect them just for you on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, while you're there, if you would, leave a comment. Tell us what you think of us. Do you love us? Do you hate us? That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right. Well, moving on. Woody Allen recently earned his 24th Academy Award nomination for the movie Blue Jasmine, and he was just awarded a Lifetime Achievement statue from the Golden Globes. On aesthetic merits alone, no one would likely object to such honors being bestowed on, we have to admit it now, one of the world's great filmmakers. But during the Globe ceremony, his own son tweeted, "Missed the Woody Allen tribute. Did they put the part where a woman publicly confirmed he molested her at age 7 before or after Annie Hall?" I think we should begin this segment by saying outright, we have no special insight into who's telling the truth in this situation, and I'm confident we wouldn't be talking about it if the most relevant party to this excruciating he said, she said, were not now also discussing it. By that, I mean Dylan Farrow, the then seven-year-old girl in question. She no longer goes by that name, but she gave her first media interview to Vanity Fair. The issue was published back in November. And in the interview, she made it perfectly clear she remains unwavering in her belief that she was molested by her adoptive father, Woody Allen. In terms of the evidence, I'll only say Allen was never charged with a crime. However, he was denied visitation rights to these children, Dylan in particular, but two others. And also a New York appellate court seems to have sided with Mia Farrow's version of events. It is an excruciating, sad set of circumstances. And then I want to add also, I go and see Woody Allen's movies every year. It's like, I have come to like the ritual of it more than the movies themselves. But nonetheless, I go see them. Was this mindless or morally obtuse of me? How should we be responding to this? Did we allow ourselves to forget the fact that this man might have committed an outrageous crime?
You know, I think in this case, the might have is important. You know, this is a really complicated matter in a number of ways. And I think it gets mixed up in the fact that he did leave Mia Farrow for her adopted daughter, Soon Yi, who was, what, 19 or 20 at the time. And he was, I think, 56. And that in itself is troubling, though not illegal, not a crime. But it does suggest a kind of creepiness to him that has turned a lot of people off then and still does. I think that it's too extreme to say you can separate the art from the artist. You can't. But I think you can come to the art on its own terms. And I rewatched the first hour of Manhattan last night thinking about this stuff, kind of to see to what extent it affected my reaction to the movie. And it did affect my reaction to it. I will say, I mean, that movie, you know, people who have seen it will remember that it ends with him deciding basically to stay with his 17-year-old girlfriend. But ultimately, I did not feel implicated. I think there are many great artists over the centuries who have done horrible things. And unless you are contributing in some way to the continuing actions, you know, continuing criminal actions, I don't think that it's wrong to enjoy the art on its own terms.
Mm. But Julia, I think the interesting among, I think everything David said was interesting, but let me pick out one thing in particular. He said, over the centuries, don't we have a different relationship to a living artist who's still producing work than we have to Percy Shelley or Aristophanes or, you know, artists who may or may not have committed abominable personal acts that are now dead and buried for literally for centuries. Clearly, we can approach their work separating out from what they might have done. Is that really the case for someone like Allen, who's cranking out a movie every 13 months?
Yeah, I think that complicates the question. I mean, right, there's a ton, you know, there are a bunch of other artists in the news around issues like this right now. For example, R. Kelly, you know, the tales of his various sexual crimes and misadventures have been reexamined of late. He's someone whose music I totally enjoy, a lot of it. And I tend not to think about those stories when I listen to it. You know, Woody Allen is not an artist that I'm deeply emotionally resonant with, but I've watched and enjoyed his movies. I think I was a big defender of Blue Jasmine when we talked about it on the show a couple months ago. And we, you know, the allegations against Woody Allen didn't enter into that conversation at all. But it is complicated. I mean, I think you could make the case that the ongoing emotional harm to Dylan continues every time there's a feature story about Woody Allen, every time there's a huge amount of public adulation for his movies and his work, when there is a long ongoing tribute to his career and he gets a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Golden Globes. So that metric seems to be a tricky one, right? Do we need to completely banish from society utterly everyone who's ever done anything morally reprehensible? Should we send R. Kelly and Roman Polanski and Woody Allen all to Antarctica never to make any more art? I'm not sure we can have hard and fast rules on this.
Yeah, this is why I think the might have is important, right? And why, I mean, so Slate published a piece by Jessica Winter this past week, really laying out, here's what we know about the accusations against Woody Allen. And I think it is worth, if you're a fan, it is worth trying to understand what you can. Likewise, the R. Kelly story, there's a journalist whose name I'm going to pronounce incorrectly, I think, but Jim Derogatis. Anybody know how to say his name? Anyway, he's really pursued that story for a long time, and he made the case that there's no conviction here, but that's in part because R. Kelly is a powerful man. And if you're a fan, you're contributing to that power, and it does implicate you in that way. And I'm not an R. Kelly fan, so I haven't wrestled with that case particularly. I have gone to see Roman Polanski movies, and he was convicted of a crime. Mm-hmm. He's also, in a way, maybe not sufficiently, but has suffered in some way for what he did. He can't come back to the U.S. And I think with these Lifetime Achievement Awards, when you give someone a general award like that, you are, in a sense, celebrating the person.
Right. I mean, one standard that some astute person, I can't remember who, pointed out as a possible way of personally trying to decide how to interact with such artists. Is there something intrinsic about the nature of the abomination they've purportedly committed that somehow is reflected in the nature of the work, right? Is the work somehow exploitative in the same way, like sexually exploitative or sort of inherently abusive in a way that kind of echoes what the crime they've committed is? I mean, one, in terms of intellectual history, one of the big ones is, you know, Heidegger is arguably the greatest philosopher of the 20th century. He also was a Nazi, and his major work was published in the 1920s before Hitler rose to power. So there's this ongoing and agonized debate about whether there's something intrinsically Naziistic or totalitarian about Being in Time, his masterpiece. Okay, so same set of questions can be asked about R. Kelly or Woody Allen. And so preparing the segment, I started to sort of ask them about Woody Allen, and I came up with uncomfortable answers. I mean, there's an unusual frequency of child molester jokes in his work going all the way back to his stand-up act. The child molester for Woody Allen stands in as this kind of laugh line about the least socially acceptable human being, but he returns to it somewhat compulsively. And then I looked back at my favorite of his movies, which is Crimes and Misdemeanors. And the theme of that movie is, what is it like to commit an abominable act, a morally reprehensible act, and how do you live with yourself having gotten away with something, in that case, murder? And that's a theme that he actually comes back to in Match Point. You know, when Woody Allen wants to make a movie that grapples with a big theme is almost always the same, which is, what is it like to get a free pass? And I think in this instance, it's important to remember here that at least in part, the free pass is coming from us. And maybe we don't have to give it anymore going forward.
You know, Steve, I think that's a really interesting point, but it also works as a defense of his art in a way, because they are really searching movies on precisely this question. And that's partly why you can watch them and wrestle with those things and take something from them, whether or not the person who created them actually did the horrible things that he may or may not be getting away with.
All right. Well, why don't we wrap this up by putting out a call to our listeners to tell us about artists that they admire for their work, but maybe abhor for their biography, and how they've learned to live with it or not live with it. Go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. All right. Well, for our third segment today, we were inspired by a wonderful piece in New York Magazine by the New York Magazine book critic Catherine Schultz, in which she talks about the five best punctuation marks in literature. She was sent off on the subject while rereading the novel Middlemarch by George Eliot, which, as she says, contains what might be the most celebrated use of an M-dash in the history of fiction. That sent her to her bookshelf, and she came up with some wonderful, I thought, Julia, really wonderful examples. A parenthesis in Nabokov's Lolita, that M-dash in Middlemarch, the ellipses in The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. She came up with some amazing stuff. Julia, do you want to read your favorite from the piece?
Oh, I mean, it's just delightful. I mean, basically what this piece made me want to do is have the brain and mental catalog of a book critic, right, of great particular sentences in literature. My recall is not nearly as good as hers is. But, you know, the first one she cites is the parentheses in Nabokov's Lolita. My very photogenic mother died in a freak accident, parentheses, picnic, comma, lightning, parentheses, when I was three. That's the quote from Nabokov. And Catherine writes, the sentence goes on for 84 more words, 11 commas, one colon, one semicolon, and another set of parentheses. But the reader, like Humbert Humbert's unlucky mother, stops dead. Nabokov is a daredevil writer and often a florid one, but what he shows off here is unbestable economy. Like the lightning inside it, this parenthetical aside is swift, staggering, and brilliant. It is also Lolita and Humbert in miniature, terrific panache containing terrible darkness. I'm hard-pressed to come up with a better parenthetical, but it's just so fun. It made me wish there were, like, annual awards for best use of punctuation throughout literature, journalism, headline writing, which is, I think, where I think about punctuation use most often. It is fun to think of punctuation marks as non-neutral units of expression. I think sometimes they're written off as the out-of-bounds marks within which the game of language is played. And, in fact, they are, I don't know, the ball. They're one of the players. They're not the referees.
The other thing that struck me about Schultz's piece, she mentioned that she couldn't find a comma. And I couldn't find it one specific comma, but it made me think of the way that Wallace Stevens uses commas at the ends of poems. They start to multiply, they start to proliferate, and somehow the kind of pausing leads you up to the ending so that when the poem is done, it feels like it's done. There's a short later poem called The Course of a Particular that ends with the lines, "It is the cry of leaves that do not transcend themselves in the absence of fantasia, without meaning more than they are in the final finding of the ear, in the thing itself, until, at last, the cry concerns no one at all." And there's the way, there are three commas in that last line, and there's a way you stop, and you stop again, and then finally there's a period. And maybe there's no single comma that can do that much work, but I hadn't really thought about these things before reading Schultz's piece and was really happy to do so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, David, those are great examples. I came up with the absence of punctuation in Molly Bloom's Soliloquy, which is the last chapter of James Joyce's Ulysses. It's thousands and thousands and thousands of words long, but it has only two pieces of punctuation, two punctuation marks in the entire thing. And I think they're right near the beginning. And doing a little internet research, I mean, obviously, it's meant to be a flood of words coming out of the mouth or unconscious of Molly Bloom, who's the wife of Leopold Bloom, the Ulysses of the book, the hero of the book. And she's based on Joyce's own wife, who he loved dearly. And his decision to have her make the soliloquy unpunctuated was because his wife's Nora Barnacle's letters to him, James Joyce, were almost completely lacking in punctuation. And in fact, she had this almost primitive relationship to language that he loved, and a kind of inability to divide it up into discrete sentences. And that influenced him in that decision.
Can I make a case for one novel bit of punctuation that I think is kind of great, which is, sometimes a writer, often on the internet, will interject into their writing open parentheses, exclamation point, close parentheses, which is sort of like a modern update of the editor's note or something, where the writer basically, it's almost like kind of a deadpan eyebrow raise at the reader, right? Where you're denoting something that you've reported or discovered or that is true, and then you put one of your little exclamation marks in parentheses, which signifies like, I know, right? Can you believe it? But then the sentence just, you know, barrels onward and you don't actually stop to make much more of a big deal about it. I think that's super fun. I mean, obviously at risk of grave overuse, and I hope it doesn't become all the rage everywhere. Otherwise, its surprise and delight would be diminished. But there's a lot of tics of internet writing that drive me crazy, like when people edit their own ums and uhs and stutters into internet prose in an effort to sound more colloquial. But for some reason, this particular one, the parenthetical exclamation mark, I love and I think is brilliant.
All right. Well, now is the moment in our show where we endorse. Julia, what do you got?
I would like to endorse a book called A House in the Sky, a memoir by Amanda Lindhout with Sarah Corbett. This is a memoir of a young woman who was kidnapped in Somalia and held captive for more than a year. And it's a tale of her life, who she is, how she came to be kidnapped, what happened during the kidnapping, and how eventually she came to be writing a New York Times bestseller. And she writes really interestingly about fear of the unknown and the relationship between fear and adventure and fear and exploration, and how in some ways it was her fear of the unknown and of new situations that pushed her to keep exploring, which I thought was a really interesting way into the mindset of that kind of backpacker bum lifestyle. So again, the book is A House in the Sky, a memoir by Amanda Lindhout with Sarah Corbett.
Ah, sounds very cool. David Hagland, what do you have?
I'm going to endorse a song, and it's one that I like so much that I confess I was tempted to keep it to myself. It's called My Adorable One, and it's by a soul singer-songwriter named Lee Moses, who recorded an album in 1971 called Time and Place. And it's fantastic. Moses was from Georgia, and he was a guitarist as well, and he sat in on some albums, I believe, but did not ever achieve a great deal of fame. He died in 1997, and his output has become very hard to find. But the song is on YouTube, so you can listen to it, and you should, and then you should maybe, I don't know, write a letter to somebody to get them to put it out again.
Lee Moses. Sounds great. So speaking of artists whose personal lives or biographies don't inspire you to love them more, you know, my two favorite poets are probably Philip Larkin and Robert Frost, and both of them were, you know, just dyed-in-the-wool jerks. But in the case of Larkin, it's almost as if being such an unreconstructed bastard in his personal life was compensation for the sort of utmost tenderness with which he wrote some of his best poems. You know, the other day, as sort of solace for a friend, I sent her a copy of Church Going by Larkin, which is one of his better known poems. It's such an amazing, amazing poem. The journey that this guy takes you in the span of five or six stanzas, from a bicyclist wandering into an old abandoned church to the end of it, which is this totally conversational but very deep meditation on what these empty spaces mean and are going to come to mean, and really what it means for the cyclist to be a complete agnostic and non-believer, and whether or not he can take anything from this basically decommissioned or on the verge of being decommissioned church. It's just one of the most, it's just an unbelievable thing that a human being can do this with language. And so in a way, one almost needed maybe to psychically compensate for having that degree of sensitivity to the world to be, you know, and by way of compensation, one is a completely insensitive bastard to one's personal acquaintances. It's some sort of economy of sympathy by which someone is able to become a poet of that fineness. It's kind of sad, but anyway, it's an amazing poem. We get the poem, we don't get the bastard. Not a bad deal, right, Julia?
I'll take it.
All right, well, thanks, Julia.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, SoundCloud, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Chris Wade and Mike Voilo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone in the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week.
Please! It be true!